Across the UK, across continental North America, and around the world on the internet by webcast and by podcast, my name is Howard Hughes, and this is a special edition of The Unexplained. Very good reason for this being a special edition. We're not going to do the regular stuff this time round, but there is, as I say, a very good reason for that. You might remember about 6 months or so ago, I put out an appeal for what has become the lost edition of the radio show. I don't have a copy of it for this simple reason. The digital copy that I took of the show, and I tended to record everything that I did, became corrupted. So, in other words, you could hear one word and then you'd miss the next three. It is, as we say, unplayable. So, this particular show, I don't have. So, 6 months ago, I started making appeals for the show with Al Bielik, the man behind the Philadelphia experiment. You may have heard of this, the Montauk Project, the time-shifting experiment that apparently the United States Navy, United States government did. So I got Al Bielik, the man who was involved in this, he says, and has over the years occasionally talked about it. I managed to track him down. And in 2005, we put him on the radio show, and that show got more response from listeners than any other show of its kind that I'd ever done. Now, as you know, I was very new to it all then, back in 2005. I'd only been doing it for 5 or 6 months or so, and I was still feeling my way about how you introduce these subjects to the public of Europe, because that show was on AM radio, and I had listeners right the way down into Europe by night, and on the internet I had listeners all over the world. So it was a big deal for its day, but I was feeling my way. So one day I heard about the Philadelphia experiment. I'd heard Al Bielik on American radio once before. I realized he was not an easy man to get hold of, so I tasked my young producer to try and track him down, and I gave him a few leads, and I said, if you can do this, I'm going to buy you not just one beer, I'm going to buy a case of beer. Anyway, we did the research, and eventually we came up with a phone number for Al Bielik. We tried the number. The guy answered, and one thing led to another. The next thing, he was on the radio show. We did a full hour with him back in 2005, and it was, for me, an amazing hour because I wasn't sure of what to expect. I half thought that the story would sound so cuckoo, so wacko, that I wouldn't believe it, and nobody else would. Then I talked to Al, and I felt that he sounded credible. Now, it's an amazing story, and you may think it's far-fetched, but listen to the tone in his voice. People who are lying, I don't think, sound like that. But, you know, I'm not a scientist, I'm not a researcher, I'm not a psychologist, so what do I know? Here's the good news. After my appeals, a couple of weeks ago, I got an email from a guy called Patrick. And Patrick, if you're listening to this, I think you will be. Thank you very, very much. Patrick said, I have a recording of that show. Would you like it? Would I? So he's emailed it to me. Now, the recording is off AM radio, but sounds good. It's a good quality, very clear recording from AM radio. The beginning of it has very, very, very slight phasing on it because it was just as dusk was falling, night was beginning to fall, and that's when you get the same program on distant transmitters slightly phasing in and out. I think you get that in America where stations carry the same show. There's not very much of it. And it disappears within 10 minutes or so. There's none of it because night has properly come down. And it's a very clear, very good recording. Amazingly good for AM radio and well recorded by Patrick. So what I'm doing in this special edition now is offering that show to you as edition 68. I've taken out commercial breaks and other stuff, so all we have is Al Bielik. And it's taken a little bit of a time to do, but it's worth it. I think, I hope. Let me know what you think. And Patrick, I'll be forever indebted to you for doing this for me. Thank you very, very much. So in just a moment, we're going to go back to 2005, live across the United Kingdom and across Europe, The Unexplained, on the radio, on the air, and an AM radio recording of Al Bielik from the Philadelphia Experiment. I can't wait. Thank you very much to Adam Cornwell at Creative Hotspot in Liverpool for getting this show out to you and for very quickly getting our 9/11 special out. Adam got that out within an hour, so thank you, Adam, very much indeed. Great service from Adam at Creative Hotspot, and I've had a lot of feedback to that show. Very much a part of my life, as you know, and I know from the emails that I've had, part of your lives too. Please keep your emails coming. Go to our website, www.theunexplained.tv, www.theunexplained.tv. Leave me feedback. Please, if you can, give me a donation to help this work continue. It's all done on an absolute shoestring. You know I want to build this into something far, far bigger. And we are going to do it. But it's going to take time and it's going to take participation. But listen to me, the mainstream media, if you haven't found this out already, and a lot of you who email me have, is not going to serve you in the future. It's not going to give you the information that you need. It's not going to touch subjects like this. And it's only going to be about selling you stuff, I think. So that's why we need voices like this one, shows like this and others of this kind on the internet. This is where we get freedom. Okay, so go to www.theunexplained.tv and find out what we're all about here at The Unexplained. All right, let's get to it. An archive recording now, recorded off AM radio, but a nice clear recording. Thank you again, Patrick. This, in 2005, is Al Bielek from the Philadelphia Experiment.
Al Bielek, it is a delight, I have to say, to have you on. Thank you very much for being part of this show.
Well, thank you. You're honoring me by asking me to be on your show.
Well, I think you have a story, Al Bielek, that has to be told. And to tell you the truth, and I've been doing like news and broadcasting all my professional life, on this occasion, I'm not sure where to start. So help me out here. Where do I start with the story of the Montauk Project and the Philadelphia Experiment?
Well, the two were separate, but they became interlocked. The first one was a product, as far as the Philadelphia Experiment, which originally was called Project Invisibility and was under the direct control of Nikola Tesla. He was the one that started it.
This is the man who invented the Tesla coil, the electrical thing that spun.
That's right, yeah? And the whole electrical AC system we use in the world today.
Okay, and what was it all about, and who was behind this research? What was it to do?
What was it to do, and what was it to be? It was an attempt to make a Navy ship or a transport ship of any kind invisible to radar, as well as invisible to sight.
Now, we just have to pause for a second there, because the stuff we are talking about here is amazing on a whole variety of levels, Al, because here we're talking about the U.S. government involved in stuff like this, and we're also talking about something that most of us would think is the kind of thing that you would see in a movie. But here we had, and what year was this?
Well, the project started actually in 1932-33.
All right, here we had in the 30s some people in the States trying to do something straight out of science fiction. How come?
Well, Tesla had this idea that what do you do to make an object invisible? And he was going on with quite a long study program on this, but he didn't build any equipment or make any tests until in 1933, Franklin Delano Roosevelt was elected 32nd president of the U.S. Roosevelt knew Tesla from 1917, 1918, World War I, when he, Tesla, did some work for the government then on communications. So we invited him down to Washington, and they had a little discussion, and Tesla told him what he was working on and attempting to do, and Roosevelt said, well, that sounds good to me. He says, tell you what, I'll see that you get some Navy money for it, some Navy research money, but move the project out of where it is now and put it in the area down in southern New Jersey.
Do you know what the surprise is here, Al? I'm sorry to interrupt you, because the story is amazing. But that Roosevelt was not fazed or, as we say in the UK, taken aback by having something so outlandish suggested to him.
No, the president wasn't, because he was on top of many things at that time, and there were a lot of things going on which, of course, were highly classified. But Tesla started this thing as an unclassified project. It was an open research program at the Institute of Advanced Study at Princeton, New Jersey. He ran it from there.
And how was it documented? Because it is amazing stuff, and the U.S. media is fairly free, you know, compared with other medias in
the
world.
It was documented within the Institute itself, because eventually, after the first successful test in 1940, on a small Navy ship in the Brooklyn Navy Yard, it was classified and became known as Project Rainbow. That was a classified name for it.
And what happened there?
Well, then the whole thing became classified, and they moved the project into some government buildings and offices in the Philadelphia Navy Yard. That's how it acquired its name, the Philadelphia Project, because they ran it basically out of the Philadelphia Navy Yard. And also they kept the research program going down at the Institute of Advanced Study at Princeton. So when Duncan and I, my brother and myself, became involved in this, and that's a long story how we became involved, See, I was not born as Al Bielek. I was born as Edward Cameron. And
how so?
Brother by the name of Duncan Cameron.
How so?
Well, that was the original family. My current name of Al Bielek is a legal name, and that came about much later on. It came about in the 50s when the Navy decided I knew too much and they had to get rid of me, so they did something which is called age regression, put me back into a much younger body, same body actually, they shrank it, and that was using German technology.
Okay, we need to get to that a little bit later, and I'm sorry for just taking you off down that cul-de-sac there, but I think we just needed to at least introduce that, because we'll hear more about that soon.
Right.
So here we are, the Philadelphia experiment.
Family.
Okay, the Philadelphia experiment is happening, but it's classified. What are they doing? What are they trying to achieve, and how far did they get?
How far did they get? They actually were quite successful in their first test. The first test, which was July 15th, 1943, full test, not a small ship, but a full-size ship, which was a destroyer-type ship, destroyer class, actually a larger, a small cruiser. But that test was conducted out of the Philadelphia Navy Yard downriver near a location called Tinicum Island, where they put the ship with a whole volunteer crew on station, and then by radio communication had the equipment turned on. Duncan and I were in charge of the equipment on board the ship, which was very specialized equipment, specially designed for the test, and we had to turn it on and do the proper numbers, if you will, with the right settings and all of that.
So you flip the switch and what happens?
Well, the ship went invisible, and this was by another mile or a mile away.
How big was the ship, Al?
I'm sorry?
How big was the ship?
The ship was the size of a, let us say, a large destroyer escort.
Okay, I can see what
you're... 1,600 tons.
I have an idea now, and I think a lot of people in this country will too. So it's not something that you can easily lose, is it?
No, it's not something you can easily understand.
And
because
you're
physics
saying
is very complex.
That in the 1940s, your team flipped a switch and it disappeared. It just simply wasn't there.
And the ship faded out and became invisible, yes.
All right,
invisible not only to sight, but invisible to radar, because it was important at that time. They wanted radar invisibility because the Germans also had radar at that time, though most people didn't know it.
And what was the name of this ship?
It was called the Eldridge for convenience, but it was not the Eldridge.
Okay, let's pause right there because this is a good stopping off point. Stay right there, Al, because there's an awful lot more to say here. And if you want to talk to Al Bielek when you've heard his story, 08704-2020. Al Bielek is online now telling you the most amazing story, and you have to admit, if somebody is lying to you, they don't recall so much detail with such clarity, or do they? I don't think so. Al, it is a pleasure to have you on. It was worth all the effort getting you on this show. So there we are in the dockyard at Philadelphia. The ship, the Eldridge, disappears. What happens then?
Well, it wasn't in the yard. We took it out downriver about 6 miles to do the test, where they would have plenty of room in case something went wrong. They would have a room for a small aircraft carrier, which was adjacent to it, to be the observing ship. And when we turned everything on... The ship disappeared in a haze, a greenish sort of haze.
But you were on board?
Yes, I was on board.
So
and
what happened to you?
Because we ran the equipment for
the
test.
What happened to you, your brother, and the crew?
Yeah, and the crew, right.
What happened?
Approximately, the last figure I was able to nail down was approximately 75 people for the test crew. The normal ship complement was 150.
Right.
Wartime, 300. But there's about 75, was maybe a little less than that, but around 50 to 75 volunteers for the program. They were all volunteers because they didn't know what would ultimately happen, and they wanted these guys to volunteer and sign their lives away in case something went wrong.
Because let's face it,
you couldn't save the Navy.
You could die.
Yes.
You could have died there.
Some people did.
All right, so you're in invisibility, and it's a big stretch of the imagination that we have to take hearing this to believe this, but let's just suspend disbelief for a minute. You're invisible, the ship's invisible, the crew's invisible. What happens to you all?
Well, in the first test, nothing. The crew was not invisible to each other. Inside the ship and inside the field, you didn't see anything different. It looked like everything was still there, but all you got was a haze and a fog if you looked over the railing.
So what is it, in terms that I can understand, and I'm not scientific or technical in any way, really, what is it that you generated that made this happen?
What you do is you have to tamper with the electromagnetic fields around the Earth. You have to tamper with the gravity field, and you have to tamper with the time field. Now, when I say time field, most people don't understand that there is such a thing, but in the more modern classified physics, they know it exists because they do time travel all the time. But in any case, at that time, it was
not well understood. But who do time travel all the time now?
Oh, yes, they do it now.
Who do it?
The U.S. government.
All right.
And this was one of the things that came out of that experiment, because the first test, things went very well. The ship became invisible to sight and invisible to radar, and they thought they had a fully successful test. But the Navy decided they wanted a change made. They wanted radar invisibility only, and they did not want visual invisibility, because they said if you're in a convoy at night in a bad storm out at sea, if you can't see the Asian ship, you're going to ram it.
And how can you signal each other?
What they wanted was totally and only radar invisibility so that the Germans couldn't find the convoy. That was the idea.
Al, you had to do it again.
I'm sorry?
You had to do it again then.
Yes, they had to do it again.
And what happened?
Well, the second test was a disaster. We went to the same location, we turned all the equipment on, things seemed to be going okay initially, but then we realized something was wrong because of the way the electronic equipment was working in the control room and related equipment. We were getting strange readings. We were getting arcovers of equipment that shouldn't have been arcing over. And finally, we got on the radio and said, we want to talk with somebody. We need to shut the equipment down. Well, we couldn't raise anyone on the radio. So just as they told us, something might go wrong. You're on your own. You have to do what you think is best. So we did. We tried to shut the equipment off. We could not. Every handle, every knob, every control was frozen. We couldn't move a thing. We couldn't change a thing. And we knew things were very much wrong. So we decided, let's get out of this control room, go outside on deck. So we opened the deck door, walked out on deck, and we saw sailors running around, milling around in a very strange manner. And we didn't see anything else other than that. It was obviously wrong. We both got the idea at the same time, Duncan and myself, let's jump overboard and swim ashore. So we got the idea and we followed it. We jumped overboard.
Could you see the shore?
Huh?
Could you see the shore?
No. You couldn't see anything beyond about 3 feet. 3 to 6 feet out, there was a greenish haze, and that's all you could see. It was a greenish haze.
So there you are in a situation where it's every man for himself, and you and Duncan decide to dive off the ship.
That's right.
What happened then?
What happened then is we started falling, and we didn't know what was happening. We kept falling, and falling was like you were going down an elevator shaft that had no bottom. And we simply didn't know what was going on. But we knew something was wrong. Well, eventually, we landed at night on our feet inside of a military base. And we didn't know where it was or where we were, but suddenly we were spotted by a blinding searchlight with the aircraft that was overhead. And we found out later it was a helicopter. In 1943, there were hardly any helicopters. They were all experimental. But MPs came out and grabbed us and took us to a building in an elevator and down several levels in this building. And then we saw a lot of other military and civilian personnel running around, and one elderly gentleman in a gray business suit with green white hair, what was left of it, walking towards us. And he says, "Gentlemen, I've been expecting you. I'm Dr. John von Neumann." Now, John von Neumann was the man who took over the project from Tesla when he bowed out. He bowed out in March of 42 because he said he did not want to be responsible for the deaths of sailors due to the fact that such high-powered equipment would be necessary in order to make a battleship invisible.
So you dive off the ship in the 1940s, you fall through some kind of vortex or whatever it might be, and you find yourself on a military base talking to the man who had taken over the project.
Yes, he was had taken over the project, and he says, "I'm Dr. John von Neumann." We look at him and says, "You can't be. We just left him an hour or so ago, and he was a much younger man." And he looked at us and says, gentlemen, I am the same Dr. Von Neumann you knew in 1943. This is 1983, and you're at Montauk, Long Island. So we looked at him and thought he was a little bit daft. But he says, come with me, I'll give you a Cook's tour. And he gave us a quick tour around. We saw all kinds of electronic equipment, computers that did not exist in 1943, namely, at that time, the best currently available was the IBM 360s and 370s.
Well, Al, you knew what you were getting into, I guess, at that point, but even somebody who was involved in that experiment, I don't know how you would feel, but as a human being, wouldn't you panic? You've gone forward 40 years.
Well, we weren't sure of that statement at first. What happened was, Neumann says, well, I got things to do in my office here. I'll sit you down in the lounge and watch TV for a while, and I'll come back and get you. Sat us down in the lodge, and I should say the lounge, and we started watching color TV, large screen color TV, which did not exist in 1942.
Well, what you had in 1942 were like 5-inch screens, weren't they?
10-inch, 630TS RCA chassis is all we had.
Okay.
And it was a 10-inch black and white screen. So here we see wall-sized projection, color TV, and we start watching the content. The content was watching freeway traffic jams around the big cities and discussions about man and the moon and discussions about the Cold War. And then the thing that really got to us was one of the commercials. On your next vacation trip to Hawaii, why not fly with us? And this was American Airlines, if I remember correctly. Fly with us in our 747 jet. And then they show a picture of a 747 jet in flight.
Now, by the time you're sitting there and watching this on television in color,
yes,
you must realize that you know, something really serious has happened here, and this is
That's
not
right.
A joke.
We realized by that point something was very wrong. So after watching this and then seeing this commercial for a non-existent aircraft in our lexicon, we said, let's go find the old man. So we found his office. And we told him, he says, well, okay, it looks like something is very much different, very much changed. He says, gentlemen, we have a problem. I said, okay, what's that?
Well, your problem was you were 40 years in the future, I guess.
That's right. Well, he was saying just about that. He was saying, you're here in 1983, you jumped off the Eldridge, and somehow you wound up here. You got to go back to the Eldridge and shut all the equipment off. We looked at him and says, we have to go back to the Eldridge and shut the equipment off. We don't know how we got here now. How are we supposed to get back there?
40 years in the future, simultaneously on another dimension, it's really hard to get your head around this stuff, but on another dimension, that ship that you dived off is still there going through something.
Yeah. So what he told us, and how we said, we don't know how we got here. How are we supposed to get us back there? I said, gentlemen, it's no problem. We here at Montauk, we have complete control over space and time. We can send you anywhere as we want, at any time we want.
So did they get you back?
Yes, they got us back. We put us in radiation suits, sent us back to the decks of the Eldridge with instructions, and smash any equipment you have to shut the generators down with certain two or three pieces of equipment you don't touch. They were not readily accessible anyway.
So you go back to the ship, you do what you're told, you follow orders, you smash the gear up.
Right.
What happened?
Now we heard the big generators winding down. And at that point, we knew it was essentially over. So at that point, we decided to go out on deck and see what's going on. Well, that's when we see sailors running around quite crazily, some of them fading in and out of our reality. And then we see two sailors buried in the steel deck, buried in the steel.
Inside the steel?
In the steel.
How did they get there? I know that sounds like a crazy question, but how did they get there?
Well, in the process of coming back to our time, that is 43, which is our time for that reference point from which we came. Getting back there, the ship did a lot of strange shiftings, and there was a lot of shifting of realities and so forth, and if the sailors were standing in the wrong place at the wrong time, they would either flip down and fall into the steel or get frozen in the steel, and there were three more who got frozen in a bulkhead, one of which was our younger brother, Jim, who enlisted after World War II started. And third man had his hand up to his wrist buried in the steel. He's the only one that lived. They cut his hand off and gave him an artificial hand later.
So, look, Al,
this is a terrible thing, a momentous but terrible thing to happen.
Yes.
People died here. How was, if we assume that this happened, how was the U.S. Navy able and the U.S. government able to cover it up?
Very carefully. I'm not saying that to be jokeful.
Well, no, I guess you have to if this happened. You've got to be careful.
They never told any of the personnel who died or disappeared. Some disappeared by jumping overboard also and never came back.
And what about you, Albielik, because you know about it?
Yeah, well, they did. They denied that there was ever such a test. They said that the personnel were lost at sea in the war action, which, of course, was a lot of war action and a lot of other ships involved. And they lied to the families about what really happened. They have never told the true story of the Philadelphia experiment to this day.
Why are you now on the radio in the UK in 2005? Why are you now telling the story?
Why? Because I have some feeling and compassion for those who died on the ship. And I made a promise to all of those guys that I would tell the story regardless and try and get some recognition to the families of what happened to some of them, because we lost quite a few personnel on board that ship. A lot of them were lost on deck. Some of them who survived were declared crazy, insane by the Navy and put in the various locations, either the funny farms or the VA hospitals. Particularly one on Long Island and another one in Tucson, Arizona.
All right, Albert, the story is not over there, and I want to tell the rest of the story in a moment here. How come nobody has tried to keep you quiet about this, has allowed you to tell the story now?
Well, there was an attempt to keep me quiet, and I quite literally let them know I'm going to tell the story, period. They have not given me a hard time over it, because I know a few details about the story which I don't talk about, and which, if they ever harass me, I will let out, and the Navy's name will really be mud then.
But I guess, and we hear these things happen, it's not just fiction. I guess, you know, one easy way to stop you from telling this story, well, there are two ways to deal with it. Number one, let you tell the story and just assume that the public will assume you're mad, or B, get rid of you.
Yeah. Well, they don't dare get rid of me for many reasons. One of them, the only way they could get rid of me was to change my time frame and the family from Ed Cameron to Albielik, which they did do rather successfully, but they could not kill me, which is a normal way to do it. I'm not saying they couldn't do it physically. I'm saying is, for various reasons, they could not kill me, the reasons being primarily that I had traveled in time, and I had a, shall we say, an interlocking effect with the time field and going to Montauk and a few other things.
How did you come, we started here, and I want to bring you back in a circle, how did you become Albielik? Because you said you didn't start out as Albielik.
No. I was in the Navy at that time as an Ed Cameron. I had the rank of Captain in the United States Navy, as well as my brother. And if you have a clearance level high enough and a need to know, you can find the original story and the actual story. It's still in the classified files. You have to have a level clearance of at least 5. That's above presidential, by the way.
All right, so in practice, nobody's going to get to see...
Very few people can access it.
Okay.
But there are those who have. But when they do,
verified
what I said was correct.
Your identity, you say, is being changed.
Yes, changed from Edward Cameron to Albielik. And as Albielik, I was born in 1927, according to the documents and the records. As Edward Cameron, I was born in 1916. I went through grade school, private school, and graduated at the age of 16, as my brother did. And we went to Princeton. Well, he didn't go to Princeton. I went to Princeton, then Harvard. And took my PhD out of Harvard in physics. He took his PhD out of University of Edinburgh, Scotland, in physics, about the same time, 1939, 1940.
So now you are the custodian of a staggering story, of a story that, well, I can't find a word, amazing, stupendous, tremendous.
Yeah.
But I'm just wondering what now you can do with it. You know, where can we go with this knowledge? Is the knowledge that you discovered, the work that you were involved in, has that been carried forward since your time?
It was resurrected in 1947 after the third test, which was almost as bad as the second.
And were you part of it?
No, I was not part of the third test. I heard about it. They put the ship out on a much of the lower harbor, well below Philadelphia, at night on a test with long cables like the first test in the Brooklyn Navy Yard. To 1,500 feet of cable to an adjacent ship and controlled everything from an adjacent ship with nobody on board. They put the ship on station and removed all personnel. turned the equipment on, the ship went invisible, all right, but it also disappeared. When it came back, it was burning. Had a bad fire on board. So at that point, this was late 43, the Navy just scrapped the project and said, get this ship fixed up for sea duty, because we're short on ships. So they dropped the whole thing until after the war was over. And in 1947, they came back to Dr. John Van Neumann, who was still in government service then, and said, we don't know what went wrong, but we'd like you to reopen the project and see if you can find out what went wrong and whether or not anything can be salvaged out of all of this. Well, I worked with him because I was still in the Navy, and we did find out what went wrong, and he did. He built a whole new system involving a computer because he was the father of the modern digital computer. And a third and very successful, or maybe the fourth and very successful test was conducted aboard an aircraft carrier in 1953.
And Al, is that how you came, because I've heard you tell this story before, is that how you came to experience even further into the future?
I'm sorry, is that how what?
Is that how you came to experience even further into the future? Because I've heard you tell
yes.
this story before, and you've talked about going way into the future from here,
yes,
where we are now.
Part of the future that took part partly as a result of Montauk, also because in the case of the original test with Philadelphia Experiment, when I jumped overboard, I did not go directly to Montauk, nor did Duncan. We wound up in 2137. And
well, that's the bit I want to get to, and we'll do that next. We've had a couple of calls in saying this man is just reciting and repeating the story of the Philadelphia Experiment. Well, that's because he is the Philadelphia Experiment. This man is Al Bielek, and if he is to be believed, he was involved in the experiment. Now, Al, we've got to the point where that experiment was repeated with an empty ship that went on fire, and they stopped doing it for a while, and then they decided to resurrect the project, and you found yourself being catapulted forward way into the future, even from beyond 2005, where we are now.
Right.
Tell me about that.
Well, originally, when Duncan and I jumped overboard with the ship, we didn't know what was happening, and we kept falling through space, if you will. And eventually we wound up in the year 2137 in a hospital bed, that is one bed for each of us, in the same hospital room, and recovering, as they told us. We'd have been badly burned by some of the radiation in space.
This was when you jumped on overboard the first time?
That's right.
So you went to 1983 and you went to 2137?
We went to 2137 first.
And what is 2137 like?
Well, we were seeing on television what was left of civilization. There had been some terrible devastation. There had been very high death rates from an unknown bug, if you want to call it that, a virus, something or other, where the world population dropped from a 7+ billion personnel at the present time to something like 300 million total world population in 2137, and that major drop took place between now and the year 2025.
Now, Bielek, this is important. Were you able to do any research while you were there? Were you there long enough to be able to find out some things that are going to happen to us in our lifetimes now?
Yes.
Okay, tell me.
We were there long enough to find out what happened, if you want to put it that way.
Are you able to tell me something that is going to happen, say, in the next year or so?
Yes, in the next couple of years, you're going to see Earth changes. What you saw out in the Pacific with that tsunami is only the beginning. There may be a tsunami that will hit the entire West Coast. There'll be other problems, whereas we were shown the maps. The East Coast had a large piece gouged out of it around Georgia. The West Coast had wasn't totally devastated, but what was left was not terribly usable in the southern part of California.
And what about Europe and the UK?
Europe was very badly devastated. The UK disappeared. There was left what was left of
this country disappeared.
In the Warm Ocean, it just sank.
So is this, you know, a lot of scientists have talked about global warming, sea level rise, climate
yes.
change. Is that what's going to happen?
Global warming is one part of the problem. The other thing is you get a lot of violent earth shifting. There is a lot of geologic shifting starting now. It hasn't all taken place yet, fortunately. But We lose the English Isles except for Ireland and Scotland. Scotland will remain intact above water.
So essentially the high parts of this country will survive.
Right. Europe is devastated. Even the Swiss Alps drop several thousand feet. And very severe devastation in Europe. There was a lot of devastation in the U.S. For example, the U.S., the Great Lakes reformed into one lake. The Mississippi River became an inland seaway, estuary, at its narrowest point below what is now the Great Lakes. It was 30 miles wide, and they had to build a suspension bridge across the narrowest part, which was 30 miles across that river.
Now, I know you're a scientist, Al Bielik, but when you learn all of these things that are going to happen to our beloved planet Earth, because, you know, I think we all fundamentally do love the place, even though it has its flaws.
Right, I agree.
How does that make you feel, and does it make you want to go out and tell everybody?
Made me feel very unhappy with what I saw happening, but there's only one thing I can say. Yes, I want to tell everybody, get prepared for possible very serious Earth changes and population reductions. By the year 2010, the military were running everything everywhere under martial law.
That's 5 years from now.
That's right.
How's that going to happen, Al?
Severe devastation geologically, as well as unknown diseases hitting people.
So we have 5 years to prepare for it.
Got about roughly 5 years to prepare with, plus economic devastation, which will hit. The only thing I can say is the future, as I saw it, is not cast in stone. It may not happen that way. It does not have to happen that way if enough people decide in their minds they don't want it to happen, because the human subconscious is a very powerful tool when you get it working together with other people.
But surely, Al, if you are catapulted forward to 2137, you see this on television, that's, to coin a phrase, the way it is. But how
that's
can you
the way
change
it
that?
Was, as we saw it then, as the way, let us say, our reference point of departure was 1943. Now, if humanity realizes this is what's likely to happen, for example, here in the U.S., all of Florida will disappear, except for the extreme highlands on the northern edge.
As human beings with the technology that we think we know we have, how can you begin to handle and cope with the massive forces that are, as you say, will devastate the Earth? There's nothing we can do. When a tsunami hits, what can you do?
There's nothing you can do in terms of the Earth changes once they start. What you can do is if the human subconscious, if it wants to work together in unison with other people and realize that this is what we face and say, we don't want this to happen, the human subconscious working together can prevent it from happening.
And very quickly, Al, how did you get back from 2137?
Well, we didn't even know how we got there, but actually another group which pulled both of us up there into 2137, pulled me further up into the 28th century, then sent me back to get Duncan and go back to the 20th century.
We haven't got time to go into that, but just tell me, what is the 28th century like? Just tell me in a few seconds, if you can. Give me a clue. Give me a taster. I'll never see it.
The 20th century was very highly developed technically. There's a lot of new geography, a lot of new technology, floating cities. The world population settled out at about 500 million.
But at least we're still here and we're not on another planet.
100% socialistic government, which created massive problems in the long run, because human incentive died. And that was one of the problems. They made attempts in the last half of the 20th century and into the 21st century to colonize other planets outside of our solar system, and that became a complete disaster. It was not successful.
Now, Al, I don't know, we've only got a couple of minutes now to talk, and I feel I could talk to you a lot. I have to say, I would like to believe what you've said. I don't know how that I can get the kind of proof, as somebody who's worked as a journalist all his life, how I could get the kind of proof that would make it absolutely clear to me that this did happen, because it seems to me that you are, as I said, the custodian of this information, but there is no way practically that the whole world is going to believe you. And there's no way that you can prove to the whole world that that's the case, is there? There's nothing you can do for me now, really, that will absolutely prove it. There's always going to be a huge element of doubt about what you say.
The only other ones who can possibly know what's going to happen are those who have used government time travel technology and techniques. They know
but they're not talking about it, are they?
No, they absolutely are not talking about it.
So, do you feel sad when you know that here you are, in a way, a lone voice? You're on the radio in the UK now, you've been on the radio and the television in the US telling this story, but for a lot of people it's a work of fiction and they're never going to buy it.
That may be. All I can say is that's their problem. If they don't want to buy it, that's their right. I'm not going to ram it down anyone's throat. You accept it or you don't accept it. If you can't believe it and can't accept it, that's unfortunate, but that's a fact. Of course, a lot of people will not accept it. That's true.
And Al, you know, I hope you live forever, but sadly there will come a time for all of us when we're not on this planet, when we're not living anymore.
That's very true.
How would you like the story that you've told to be taken forward by the next generation?
Eventually, what I have to say will be borne out as more and more information leaks, as more and more facts leak, as eventually the government will change some of their attitudes regarding suppression of these stories and suppression of information.
Well, Al, the picture that you paint of the next 5 years is not nice. I hope it doesn't come to pass, but I'll tell you something. If it does, in 2010, if the Lord spares me, if I'm still here, the first thing I'm going to think is that Al Bielik told me this was going to happen. And I'm not sure what I'm going to feel then. But Al, I'm very grateful to you, and thank you very much for telling that story. This man's name is Al Bielik. He says he was part of the Philadelphia experiment, and I don't know how you feel after that. You pays your money, as they say, and you takes your choice.
Well, amazing for me to hear that little snapshot in time, a little bit of my life. And Al Bielik, who is very hard to get hold of these days, the last I heard of him, I believe he's in some kind of care home in Florida. Tell me if I'm wrong about that, but he is impossible to track down. The number that I've got for him doesn't answer anymore, and I've tried publishers and many other ways to try and get hold of Al Bielik. Not possible, so it doesn't seem that Al is doing interviews anymore. And Al, if you get to hear this or you get to hear about this, I send you my regards and good wishes and good thoughts for the future, wherever you are and whatever you're up to. Al Bielik from the Philadelphia Experiment. That was edition 68 of The Unexplained, brought to you by Adam Cornwell at Creative Hotspot in Liverpool. Thank you to Martin, as ever, for the theme tune. Thank you to you for listening to the show, and please tell your friends about it. Spread the word. It's the only way that we're going to get there, and we will get there. If you want to know more about the show, if you want to send me feedback about it, which I always enjoy getting, go to the website, www.theunexplained.tv, www.theunexplained.tv. Thank you again for listening. We return with edition 69 of The Unexplained.